In every tradition, there is crazy wisdom. There are the crazy tzaddiks. There are the monks laughing at the moon in Zen Buddhism. In Sufism, there is a long tradition of that. And one of the best examples is somebody called Nasruddin. It's one of his names. And there are many stories about Nasruddin as people can make up. I don't know how many actually happen. But there is a story of Nasruddin going into a bank to cash a check. It was a large check, and the teller looked at the check. Nasruddin was a very disreputable-looking fellow. And the teller looked at the check, and the check looked all right. But Nasruddin didn't. And finally he said, well, sir, the check seems fine, but can you identify yourself? And Nasruddin reached into his pocket. He pulled out a mirror and he looked and he said, yup. Now it's interesting how subtle and yet how formal our identities are and how much we're attached to them because of how much we are used to our cards of identity. My name, social security number, my zip code, my address, my occupation, a whole set of labels that define who we think we are. When you and I are born, very shortly after we're born, we go into somebody training. We start to be trained to become somebody. And we're trained by other people who know who they are. And they're going to teach us who we are. Very well-meaning, I mean, so that we can function in the world by being somebody. And you become mother's little girl or mother's little boy or somebody who eats all his carrots. You start to develop an identity after a while. You're good or you're bad or you're a rascal or you're... When I was very young, I must have maybe 9 or so, I came from a Jewish middle class family and it turned out that the best thing to want to be was a doctor. That was somebody. And everybody gave you microscopes and books and patted you and smiled. And I milked that one until I was well into college and was flunking histology and cytology and embryology. The moment of truth came. And we carry our somebodies around with us. And it allows us to be with other people in an efficient way. Now, just to get us all together into a metaphorical system, we can play in the game of metaphors any way you want. I mean, it depends on who you're talking to, you pick your metaphor. But I'm going to use one that just allows us to jump across systems easily. And if we all talk from the same one, it'll make it more fun to play. So, just imagine you have next to your eyes a television channel selector. And you set the selector on channel 1. And you see woman, man, old, young, thin, fat, dark, light. You see the physical beings. You see physical entities. You see endomorphs, ectomorphs, and mesomorphs. You're a scientist. If you are... full of lust, you would be on this channel. It's a channel in which you would see other bodies as whether or not they would fulfill your fantasies. So you would see everybody as bodies, and you would see there's a potential, there's a competitor, and that's irrelevant. And you would see everybody as one of those three. And that's the physical plane, that's what you would see, just channel 1. If you look at me, you see a 51-year-old bald man, Caucasian. And that's what you get on channel 1. Probably irrelevant. Flip to channel 2, Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. Now you see happy and sad. You see seeker. You see responsible, laid back. All the social roles, you see responsible teacher. You see judge. You see politician. You see mother. You see child. You see all of the psychological, social dimensions channeled to. If you're in psychotherapy, this is the real channel. Nothing else is real. Now, most of our cards of identity are on those two channels. Channel 2 is our storyline. Channel 2 is our psychological storyline, for the most part. It's the world turns. That's what Channel 2 is. Where am I going? Where did I come from? Will I make it? I'm lousing it up. If I can only get over this, that's all Channel 2. Channel 2, I'm a warm, affable, intelligent, charming teacher. Channel 3 is what we call the New Age channel. Scorpio. In Channel 3, there are only 12 of us. Channel 3 is also our mythic channel. It's the archetypes. It's the, I am the Buddha giving the sermon in the beer park. The room is filled with earth mothers and seekers after the Holy Grail. We all have these very big mythic roles also, besides our more paltry psychological selves. We got bigger games we're playing. And the larger whoop and woof of things. Now notice about these first three channels that they are all what you might call matrices of individual differences. They're ways we can peg each other. Channel 3, I'm an Aries. So if you go home and somebody said, who did you hear this weekend? You can say, I heard a 51-year-old, bald, Caucasian man, warm, charming, affable teacher, Aries. Then they know, and you sort of, you really notice it in the astral plane, around they say, "You, what are you?" I'm an Aries. Right, of course. And as if now that explains everything. And each plane up explains more. It actually does. It explains. It's a system. But it's a system. It's a matrix of individual differences in which you're different from you, from you, from you, from me. And we can peg each other. World of individual differences. Channel 4. Now you look into the eyes of another being and you see another being just like you looking back at you. Are you in there? Far out. I'm in here. How did you get into that one? And what you see at that moment is another awareness just like you, but packaged differently. And you see channels 1, 2, and 3 as packaging. And this channel 4, that entity, is in Christianity, it's called the soul. It's the eyes are the windows of the soul. So you see another soul just like you, but who's having an entirely different set of life experiences because they're packaged differently. And you see how much the package affects what their experience is all about. The package includes all the desires, all the fears, all the hopes, all the social perceptions. So if you and I are meeting on channel 4, see, if we're meeting on channel 1, we're meeting in snowmass at Windstar in a room. If we're meeting on channel 4, we're just these souls who happen to be sharing a moment wondering what we're doing on earth, comparing notes. And the time and space of this is just somewhat incidental to the forms we happen to be meeting in at this moment. You flip to channel 5, it's like two mirrors facing each other. You see yourself looking at yourself, looking at yourself, because in channel 5 there's only one of us. That's Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. It's not one plus Dorothy. One plus Pete, it's just one. So from channel 5, we are one in drag, or we are one at play. I mean, if you were the one in channel 5, well, what'll I do? You wouldn't say today, because you're not in today there, but you'd say, well, what'll I do? I think I'll become the many. Like, I think I'll play hide and seek. Then you become the many, and then you bring your awareness down, and you go into a little one of it. I think I'll go into some of it. And then you look out at the rest, and you say, oh, God, it's scary. And you see others as them, and then you get all scared. You say, okay, ollie and free, and you come back into the one. Whew, that was heavy. I don't think I'll play that one again. So from channel 5, we are the one at play. And just to keep the Buddhists happy, we flip to channel 6, where you disappear, I disappear, the channel selected disappears, none of it is, was. It's all void. Okay, now we have a system to play with. Now when I talk about you being born and going into somebody training, the somebody training you specifically went into was primarily channels 1 and 2. And the anxiety that was attendant to the way in which you started to become somebody. Let me point out, when you are born, you're not busy being separate. It's all one thing to you. It's all one undifferentiated thing. And then something along the way comes along, and you start to see that you aren't all of it. Now, I don't know. I have a suspicion that my critical moment was when I bit my mother's breast. And she said, hey, that's not yours. That's mine. You know? She pushed me away. There was something that happened where suddenly I had a sense that I did something that I fell out of grace. I was no longer at home in the universe. I was a separate entity that felt a yearning to get back. I suck, I eat, I grab, I want, I try to incorporate, I try to come back into the one. I am now a separate entity. I learned separateness somewhere along the way. I bought into my separateness. And the emotional loading with which you do that means that you get very, very concerned about who you are, your identity. And in order to be functional in the world, to be as a separate entity, to survive, because you begin to feel there's this vast power around you and you experience impotence or inadequacy or whatever the roots of human neuroses are, you develop a sense of separateness and there is this vastness and you're always trying to make it all right to come back in, whether you come back in through eating, through collecting, through your eyes, drawing in, through later through all of achievements, through sexuality, always trying to come back into the one, into the unity, into the feeling of being in the Tao, in the harmony of things, in the way of things, instead of being separate. And the most powerful vehicle you have on channel 2 for developing your separateness and your computer system for functioning efficiently as a separate entity, where I'm me and you're you, is your thinking mind, your analytic thinking mind, your conceptual mind. Now, the thinking mind is very addicting because it gives us so much power. The thinking mind puts us on the moon. The thinking mind does all these. The thinking mind gives us technology. The thinking mind gives us so much stuff. I grew up learning the statement cogito ergo sum. I studied Latin and it said, I think, therefore I am. Meaning you are an identity with your thinking mind. I am the thinker. Like you wake up in the morning. And from the moment you wake up, you start things like, got to go to the bathroom. And sleep 5 more minutes. It's warm in that corner of the bed. Got to do the laundry. Wonder if the stove is still hot. Smell coffee. Oh, I'm so sleepy. What was I dreaming about? Got to go to the bathroom. Wonder if the car will start. And on you start. You just start. It's like trip hammer. Think. And each one is your mind, your awareness. Just imagine your awareness being the life, and it's like, what do I think? And each thought's coming forward saying, think of me, I'm real, think of me. It's like that story of the drunk looking for the watch, and somebody comes along to help him, and they're under a street lamp, and the fellow's looking, and finally he says, well, where exactly did you lose the watch? And the drunk points up the alley. Well, what are you looking here for? He says, because there's a light here. Well, that's the situation, that you end up studying what your thinking mind can know as an object, and everything that it can't, you say, is irrelevant. Well, it turns out most of what we are ends up in the category of irrelevant. Now, most people spend their entire lives with an identity in channels 1 and 2. And it's as if they have created a room for themselves with their mind of who I am and what is me and what is not me and how it all is. And then they, no matter how miserable the room is, they will never step out of it. I mean, I get images of, I've seen that photograph in the paper of a battered child who's been burned with cigarette ends by the mother and just very badly battered. And the child is in the arms of a police matron who looks very motherly and very loving and very soft. And she's taking the baby away, and there's the mother who looks very, very angry and very bitter and hard. And the baby is screaming for its mother. It's that one. Now, if, as is the case for most people, the need of that separateness to be sure it knows where it is and how it is, and are you my friend or my enemy, and who can I get what from, and is it safe, and where do I go and where don't I go? This map, the map built from the place of my separateness. I am so attached to those identities on channel 1 and 2 that all the information that comes to me from channels 3, 4, 5, and 6 I, in effect, reject. It's all there. You exist on channel 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Now, this is the model we're playing with, and if it gets too far out, just assume I took too many drugs in the 60s or something like that. Way out. But assume the information is coming in on every one of these channels as to who you are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But you're so attached to channels 1 and 2 that the other information on these other channels you treat, and what the words you use are irrelevant, or error, or I was out of my mind, or I spaced out, or I'm losing it, or I don't know what just happened, or like when I first took psilocybin, the mushrooms, and I had these experiences which were like I experienced that I was perfect. You know, that I was part of the universe and it was all perfect. Well, I know I'm not perfect, says channel 1 and 2. So what I do in order to preserve my model of myself, which is certainly inadequate and not perfect, is I say of that experience, because I'm a psychologist, you remember, a professor of psychology, I say, interesting hallucination. You see, I have a label. It's called a reductionistic label. It's a label that makes it less than important. It's not real. Because my father used to say, Rich, come down to reality. Which meant get a job. Get your act together on this plane. As William James said in 1906, he said, our normal waking consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there may lay other types of consciousness. We may spend our entire lives without knowing of their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and there they are in their completeness. their existence forbids our premature closing of our accounts with reality. But most of us do. We say, this is reality, and all the rest of that is la-la land. It's playing. It's out there somewhere. But somewhere along the line, for some people in some birth, there is what's called awakening. What awakening is that you acknowledge that channels 3, 4, 5, and 6, specifically 4, 5, and 6, have some reality to them. You allow that they are potentially real, which means that the channels 1 and 2, which previously you were treating as absolutely real, now are only relatively real. So what you have done in that moment is you have done to your social perception what Einstein did to Newtonian physics. I learned Newtonian physics as this is absolute truth. And then Einstein came along and said, depends on where you're standing. And he just shifted it from absolute to relative reality. Now, how that awakening occurs for any individual is as varied as there are individuals. When you are ripe for that awakening, a leaf can fall, who knows? See, I, in the 60s, was part of a club of people who had all awakened through better living through chemistry. And we would have these club meetings, which were, you know, I know, and we just reassure each other that we knew. And we all identified the experience we were having with our method. All of the club used to look, they all used to dress the same way. Everybody used to wear white and they smiled a lot and they had flowers and they all smiled and they knew, you know. A lot of repressed aggression. At one lecture that was the club, and I was sort of an uncle to the club, that was my role. And down in the front row, there was a woman who was in her late 60s, and she had on a hat that had little strawberries and cherries on it. She had a black patent leather bag and a print dress and responsible-looking Oxfords. And I would say these things that only those of us that knew would know. And she would go like this. And I became aware of her in the front row, and I thought, how does she know? I mean, she's not an acid head, there's no doubt about it. So I'd say something more esoterically outrageous that only people that had really been playing out between channels 5 and 6 would even think relevant. I thought, well, maybe she has a nervous, and I went to see whether she only responded at certain moments, which she did. She only responded when I made a point. And so at the end of the lecture, I smiled broadly at her, and she came over and she said, thank you so much. She said, that was just, felt just right. I understood that perfectly. That's just the way I understand it to be. How do you know? What is it you have done that allows you to know these things we're talking about? She leaned forward very conspiratorially and she said, I crochet. And at that moment, I sort of knew that the game wasn't the one I thought it was. Because until then, I always identified the method of getting somewhere, where you got with your method of getting there. And what happens to all of us is, if your method is crocheting, you can't understand why everybody isn't crocheting. No. Crocheting is the only way, that's your way. If you do it through Zen sitting, you just feel so sorry for those poor slobs that don't sit. How much do you sit? You ask.
If yours is skiing, you can't believe that other people could be living here and don't ski. If it's sex.
You mean you are celibate?
You know, you just can't conceive of it. It's just inconceivable that somebody would throw away the ecstasy of transcendence. But yet, when you look around, you see that people arrive at that by a tremendous variety of ways. And you see, when you can separate the method from where the method takes you, you can hear that same quality of delight in a surfer, in a skier, in a sexual aficionado, in a bouillabaisse cooker, in a cabin builder, in, you know, in a problem solver. I mean, Einstein just went into ecstatic states. He went into places. He transcended. He went into places. He said, I didn't arrive at my understanding of the fundamental laws of the universe through my rational mind. Rational mind's in channel 2. He went into some other way of knowing the universe. He's trying to solve a problem about the relation of mass and energy. And he's so one-pointed in it that, just like following the breath, he goes through a doorway into another way of being in the universe in which everything is here. It's a gestalt way. It's a subjective way. It's not object. It's not subject-object. The thinking mind always thinks about something. So it's, as long as you're in your thinking mind, you're always one thought away from where the action is. You're always feeling separate from the universe because you're always thinking about the universe. You can imagine Bach just having that doorway open into another realm of relationship to the universe where the sound is, where all the laws are. And if you have that doorway open and then it comes down through you, then you can just sit around writing, just all you are really is copying in this bizarre sense. I mean, you as an instrument are merely a vehicle through which this stuff is coming. And I mean, somebody like Mozart's output, it's not like he sits down and thinks, well, what'll I do today? All he does is open up and then the stuff comes through. It's as if you go into this place where all is. It's not conceptual. It just all is. And then as you come back down into form, if you're doing it sequentially, as you come back down into form, if your form happens to be music, it comes out through music. If your form happens to be physics, it comes out through E equals MC squared. If your form happens to be art, it comes through David, Sculpture of David by Michelangelo. Now, when you go into these other altered states of consciousness, as they're called, or come into the spirit, if you want it in a religious metaphor, there are things that you see that are very different from the way you see them in what's called normal waking consciousness, or channel 2. Like when you are looking at the universe from channel 5, from the way God sees it, just outside of time and space, just you're just awareness, and it's just looking at forms. Looking down or at forms, all form. What you become aware of is that all form is law, is lawfully related. That the nature of form is that it is connected to everything else in a lawful way. It's all changing, and all the change is lawful. And you just see it. You see law everywhere you look. You can look at it in genetics, you can look at it in quantum mechanics, you can look at it in music, you can look at it in archaeology, astronomy, astrology, you can look at it in the Kabbalah, you can look at it in I Ching, you can look at it in the Quran, you can, etc. Well, everywhere you look, you see law. And you see everything is related to everything else lawfully, including your body. And when you see all this law related, which includes psychology and sociology and suffering and death and violence, and it's all lawful, from that point of view, when you look out and you just see the law, you say, it's perfect. Because you see the perfection of the law made manifest. It's all perfect. But then you come back down into your human heart. Perfect? I mean, when you look at the world, does it seem perfect to you? The suffering starvation, violence, paranoia, the fear in people. Look in yourself. Look at your own suffering, your own neuroses. Want to call that perfect?